I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. We need a special counsel to investigate the six conservatives on the Supreme Court. We know Harlan Crow spent thousands on Clarence Thomas. For what precise purpose? We know somebody paid off Brett Kavanaugh's debts. Who? When? Why? We know Leonard Leo's gang spent millions to put Gorsuch and the others in place. What did they get in return? We know the Trump appointees all lied to the Senate and said Roe v. Wade was settled law, then voted to overturn it. Were they paid to do so? Indirectly? Directly? We know the conservatives looked at the 14th Amendment, which states when, why, and how to appeal disqualification from the ballot, and ignored the Constitution anyway. To what end? We know those conservatives have now signaled that they will countenance a coup or presidentially ordered domestic assassinations or anything so long as they can pretend they were official acts by a president and so long as they don't have to rule until and unless Trump is president again. What inducement could make even conservatives, even conservative lawyers, prostitute themselves in that way? And most of all, we know that if the polarity was reversed, if this were a Republican administration now, and that were an utterly corrupt and criminal Democratic president on trial, and a 6-3 liberal Supreme Court impeding and slowing and obstructing justice, we know what the Republican administration would do. It would accuse the six liberal justices in public, hourly, of corruption. And it would appoint a special counsel to turn their lives upside down and the lives of some fictional liberal versions of Harlan Crow and Leonard Leo and hundreds of other people. We know this would be happening right now. There would be a special counsel prosecuting them today. Regardless of the consequences, regardless of the optics, regardless of the blowback, regardless of the traditions, regardless of the date on the electoral calendar. Because part of the reason Trump and his minions and the Supreme Court are warning about a political vortex in which every departing president will be prosecuted by his successor is that the conservatives are doing what they always do. They are setting those mechanisms in place to prosecute and marginalize and gerrymander and cheat against Democrats and liberals and anybody who will stand in their way, and then finding some high horse on which to jump and to suddenly claim that the process is sacrosanct and any action by any Democrat against any Republican is necessarily partisan and wrong and against the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. And now that they own the Supreme Court, it's also unconstitutional. We need a special counsel appointed by the Department of Justice to investigate the six conservative members of the Supreme Court today, and Leonard Leo, and Harlan Crow, and the entirety of the Federalist Society, and the Claremont Institute, and Russell Vogt, and Steve Bannon, and Stephen Miller, all of them. Drag them through hell as fast as possible. Well, as slowly as possible. Because at least three Supreme Court justices are perjurers. And five or six of them had to have reasons other than constitutional ones to ignore the 14th Amendment. And all six of them are clearly in the bag for Trump presidential immunity in some form, but not for Biden presidential immunity in any form. Alito and Barrett and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and Roberts and Thomas are crooks. We've known that for a long time. And not only do we need to find out now how crooked they are, but we need to know if they and their masters have left what these arrogant, condescending, domestic, conservative terrorists always leave, a trail a mile long. The attorney and analyst Joyce Vance had a far less dramatic and maybe far more effective than my default position of scorched earth idea. She heard the same subtext to the Supreme Court hearing last week. We're going to help Trump. We just have to figure out something to write that sounds like we're not helping Trump. Her expectation aligns with my guess that they'll send the case back to Tanya Chutkan with a phony checklist that she must fill out of what might be official duties deserving presidential immunity and what isn't deserving presidential immunity. Vance suggests that to do what the corrupted Supreme Court wants there, Judge Chutkan should have an evidentiary hearing on remand. In other words, in Vance's words, briefs and even live testimony where the government would get to lay out all of its evidence against Trump. The House January 6 committee hearings, she writes, gripped the nation. The special counsel, with access to the powers of an investigative grand jury and the possibility of more cooperating witnesses, would have an even larger story to tell. In other words, no Trump criminal trial for subverting the election because the Supreme Court subverted the trial? Put him on trial in the court of opinion before the election. Does this evidence about which senators Trump called on January 6th deserve immunity, Jack? I don't know, Tanya. Does it? Does this evidence of Trump demanding the magnetometers be disabled before his speech so his militias could bring machine guns to the Capitol, does that deserve immunity? Empty the damn evidence vault under oath. And in his newsletter, Off Message, the impeccable Brian Beutler adds another layer. If the court really does kneecap Jack Smith, quote, Senate Democrats could haul him before the Judiciary Committee to air any information the public has a right to know. And Beutler also adds one more dimension to something else I've emphasized here. Any presidential immunity the court might try to invent for Trump would have to go for Biden. Beutler says, quote, Biden could warn the court, really the Republican justices, not to contrive a new category of presidential immunity, official acts or otherwise, by promising to exploit any new powers the court vests in him while he enjoys them, unquote. I love this. He also notes that there's a lot of stuff an immunized Biden could do that would not fall to Trump's levels, but would still remind the court that it does not run this country, no matter what Sam Alito thinks. To quote Beutler again, the Constitution gives the president all kinds of non-murderous powers that, if abused, could nevertheless throw the Republic and Trump's best-laid plans into disarray. Biden could theoretically order Congress into session to debate legislation to expand the Supreme Court. When the House and Senate disagree, as they surely would, over when and whether to adjourn the special session, Biden could then force Congress into adjournment indefinitely. It's right there in Article 2. He could leave Congress adjourned through the election, readjourn it if necessary, and refuse to convene the House and Senate again unless it certifies the winner of the national popular vote. This would, of course, represent a flagrant violation of the rules and the Constitution, and would plunge the nation into crisis, but it would also be within the president's official powers, and thus, presumably, immune. I love that, too. What these ideas all underscore is that we, I mean all of us who have a faint hope that there will be representative government in this country a year from today, we must stop assuming that being right about everything decides everything anymore. If ever it did. And the Biden campaign is going to have to stop assuming that the president being right and good and Trump being the worst person in this country's history is going to be enough. We need to go on offense. And the goal has to be to metaphorically gut the bastard and to metaphorically gut all the other bastards in Trump's gang. As said by the character of the prime minister in House of Cards, the good version, we need to put a bit of stick about, because there is already political persecution in this country, and there is already a two-tier justice system. And if you don't believe it, ask any woman needing reproductive health care in a red state. Ask them if they are not being persecuted. Ask Trump's lawyers who walked out of the Supreme Court muttering to themselves, "We made up this entirely fictitious immunity bullshit based on absolutely nothing in the Constitution and nothing in American history, and Alito and these other assholes said, sure, whatever." The point is, liberals and Democrats and women and minorities and constitutionalists and small R Republicans and small D Democrats alike and all non-fascists have to win the political persecution that began long ago in this country against us. And we have to win the two-tiered justice system that has kept a political party that should have been killed off by the demographics a quarter century ago, not just alive, but in power, despite an ever-shrinking minority. We have to metaphorically kill them and eat them. We need a special counsel to investigate Supreme Court corruption, and at minimum have a Robert Hur kind of report with which to bonk them. We need a court evidentiary hearing and a Senate panel into what Jack Smith found. We need Biden to warn the court, maybe in a primetime speech, that would be fun, that they are playing with fire and wearing robes while they play with fire. We need the Biden campaign to hire a couple of Joyce Vances and Brian Beutlers. And the Supreme Court, where they may be many things, but tough is not one of them, would be a great place to start. Hell, we've seen that asshole Kavanaugh under pressure. If we can sweat him enough, he might even flip on the rest of those dicks. I'm not sure if Trump's mental illness has spread from speech problems to written problems, but something is going on, something new. It could just be a brief from a lawyer about more from, I don't know, E. Jean Carroll or some other actual private legal action. Or it could be that Trump is now so sick that he is conflating the prosecutions in federal court in Florida and Washington and state court in New York and Georgia with lawsuits. 6:15 yesterday morning, he writes of all of these ridiculous D.C.-inspired lawsuits against me. Drop the lawsuits. The New York lawsuit, or as those of us who've only sustained partial head injuries call it, the criminal trial, resumes today. And whatever is wrong with Daddy, evidence is that it is hereditary. The dumber of his grown sons, Eric, has now joined Trump's fantasy that there are 11 billion pro-Trump protesters out there being held back by sweating, heaving New York cops. Quote, "My father is drawing these massive crowds." At the New York trial, he isn't. No crowds at all. Moreover, the right-wing fantasy that there are barricades holding them back somewhere out of frame is wildly untrue. I mean, you can't necessarily walk into the courthouse and stop by and say hi to Donnie on the 15th floor, but the blocks around the building are completely open. The only disruptions now are on the highways when they drag Trump's ass to and from the courthouse. Thursday, by the way, hearing number two into Trump's gag order violations, and I'm beginning to suspect that Justice Merchan does not want to do what the law tells him he must do. Also, as the Trump hush money and election interference trial resumes, or as he calls it, nap time, the Biden campaign has finally found its template for going after Trump. On its social media yesterday, quote, "Trump continues to sleep through his Haley voter problem." Brilliant and endlessly useful. Around the Trump legal league, proving nobody learns anything ever, Rudy Giuliani went on Real America's Voice yesterday and said that Speaker Mike Johnson and Jim Jordan should make all further Ukraine aid dependent on, well, see if this sounds familiar, quote, "somebody should lean on Zelensky. You want another penny? Give us your Biden file," unquote. This is what happens when you inject a liquid form of the Viagra directly into your own brain. Even Giuliani's instinct to blackmail the man who ended his political career goes into reruns. Meanwhile, another version of Real America's Voice called One America News just retracted its smear against Michael Cohen that it was he who had the affair with Stormy Daniels. They retracted it just 33 days after they smeared him. This is a record. Hunter Biden apparently served notice 2 weeks ago that he intended to sue Fox over its endless defamations of him, and they asked for more time to, burn the records? Which makes me circle back to investigations. Hunter Biden cannot sue James Comer and Marjorie Trotsky Greene over how they slandered him in the House. But where is the special counsel investigating why what they said about him and what others said about him matched, sometimes word for word, what Russian intelligence disinformation said about him, and which all depended on an expatriate Russian witness who says he was in indirect contact with Russian intel and who was then arrested for lying to the FBI. It is absolutely possible that Jamie Comer and Midge Green were moronic dupe idiots. I mean, just look at them. But once again, the Department of Justice has a big budget, and would-be special counsels apparently hang around headquarters each morning like day workers at construction sites. Let's go! I want 73 special counsels by the beginning of next week. Now we know why the surge in 2020 fake electors investigations and indictments is happening. CNN found out that Kenny the Cheese, Trump lawyer Ken Chesbro, had a burner account on Twitter and didn't exactly tell the Attorney General of Michigan, Dana Nessel, about it, even though investigators asked. And he said no. And the answer actually was yes. Behind the scenes, Nessel sued and got hundreds of files, including his DMs to and from Chesbro. Now, in addition to everything else, and whatever unfolds from this everywhere else, Chesbro may also face charges of lying to the investigators in Michigan. The indictments on this subject in Arizona are so panoramic that they indicted State Senator Jake Hoffman just as he was being elected a Republican National Committee member for Arizona, and they indicted Trump attorney spokesmodel Christina Bobb as she was being appointed senior counsel for the same committee's Election Integrity Team. As Morty the pathologist says to Jack Nicholson in Chinatown, "And that's something, middle of a drought and a water commissioner drowns." And no cancellation yet from interviewer or interviewee, but this is how Face the Nation ended on CBS Sunday.
Join us next week when we'll talk to South Dakota Republican Governor Kristi Noem about her new book, No Going Back.
Oh, there's still time for Noem to cancel, or the publicists to cancel, or CBS to cancel, or CBS to make it pay-per-view, or, most appropriately, for CBS to lure Noem into a gravel pit for the interview. There's also the question of the book itself. It's being published by Center Street, a conservative imprint of Hachette, one of the Big Five publishers. It used to be Time Warner Books. It still publishes Little Brown and many others. It may want to bail out on this book before the boycott begins. And as to Noem, a psychopathic sadist, I think I said all I needed to say over the weekend on social media about this monster, and thank you for all of the kind words as I told the story of my rescue Minet and the moment he realized I was now his human and the transcendent affection of that and all of our time since. That chance for some kind of love like that that Noem destroyed when she shot poor Cricket. What matters now will be what happens when Noem next tries to surface and do something, anything, that is not about the fact that she murdered her daughter's puppy because she failed to train it and she could not be bothered to give it away to someone else or to a rescue or to a shelter. I can add only this. Two old found tweets. On September 26th of last year, someone tweeted a link to a CNN story and added, quote, Commander Biden bites another Secret Service agent, the 11th known incident, no such thing as a bad dog, just a bad owner, unquote. Then 2 months and 9 days ago, in February, another CNN link and another subtweet, same account. Biden's dog commander bit Secret Service personnel in at least 24 incidents. Experts say there are no bad dogs, just bad dog owners. I agree. The author of both of these tweets? Corey Lewandowski. Corey Lewandowski, as in per the New York Post of last September 15th, married Republican South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem has engaged in a years-long affair with longtime Trump advisor Corey Lewandowski, multiple sources told the Post Friday, unquote. It is our task now to make certain that for the rest of her life, and may she live to be 206, Kristi Noem and everyone who supports her spends every minute inside a metaphorical gravel pit. Also of interest here, panic at the New York Times over the AG Sulzberger Biden grudge story, and it's so bad that the official statement from the Times denying it is anonymous. And yes, if you were paying attention yesterday, you knew this was going to happen. Guess who made the worst persons list thanks to Nancy Pelosi? One of my exes. Now, can you guess which one of my exes? That's next. This is Countdown.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
On this edition of Countdown, it is rare when one person is the star of Worst Persons in the World and Things I Promise Not to Tell, and I Used to Live with Them, and they get killed daily on social media, and now they get killed on their own newscast by another friend of mine who used to be the Speaker of the House of Representatives. But while it may not be Thursday, it is Turday on Things I Promise Not to Tell coming up. First, still more new idiots to talk about, and there is overlap. The daily roundup of the miscreants, morons, and Dunning-Kruger effect specimens who constitute today's Worst Persons in the World. The bronze. I don't want to give this to Cindy Adams. It was her birthday party, but A, she's 94 years old. B, given her career writing about celebrities, she's a really dedicated reporter. She's taken the accuracy of her stories way more seriously than anybody else in her field. And C, she called me up years ago and said, I just saw your show for the first time. I think it's exactly what our country needs right now. How can I help you in my own silly way? So the bronze is to whoever leaked this list of guests to New York Magazine, quote, spotted at Cindy Adams's 94th birthday party, Kathy Hochul, Andrew Cuomo, Eric Adams, Woody and Sun Yi, Al Sharpton, Kellyanne Conway, Bill O'Reilly, Don Lemon, Robert Thompson, Keith Poole, Al Sharpton, unquote. What was the title of that book? The 12 People You Meet When You Go to Hell? Was that it? 12 people you go. Andrew Cuomo? O'Reilly? Kellyanne Conway? Jesus, Cindy, after they left, I hope you counted the spoons. Also, why is Al Sharpton listed twice? Are there two Al Sharptons? Are there? The runners up, worser, the New York Times. You may recall that writer Peter Baker and an executive named Elizabeth Buemiller and the publisher A.G. Sulzberger all made this list last Friday after Politico's expose on Sulzberger's vendetta against President Biden because he will not give the Times a one-on-one exclusive. So bad that during a one-on-one exclusive with Vice President Harris, he wasted some of the time arguing with her to ask Biden on the Times' behalf to do the interview, pretty please. So bad that Politico quoted a Times journalist who said it was Sulzberger who responded to this by ordering the newspaper to keep doing stories on Joe Biden's age until he proves to them he's not too old by successfully doing a good one-on-one with the Times. The quote, it's AG, he's the one who's pissed that Biden hasn't done any interviews and quietly encourages all the tough reporting on his age, unquote. The Times has fallen apart over this.
Nobody is denying that Sulzberger asked the vice president, pretty please get him to do the interview, please, 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 please. Don't let him do an interview with the Post, for God's sakes. Or what if it's the Daily News, the New York Daily News? We'll have to go out of business. I just made that part up. Nobody is denying the president went on with Howard Stern, though, just to thumb his nose at the Times last week. But this idea that the publisher ordered the negative coverage and was intentionally or inadvertently helping Trump as a result, as petulant revenge. On Sunday morning, Maggie Haberman posted a 7-tweet thread, each with a link to a Times piece in which the Times had criticized Trump. Deportations, they'd be bad. Pulling out of NATO, that would be bad. Prosecuting Biden, problematic. It was clearly a response to the political story on the weekend of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, no less. And as a response to that, it's pretty damn mediocre. We know Trump is bad. He says he wants to be a dictator. He says he's going to be bad to people. America needs the Times to show a little enthusiasm and burn Trump down, like it helped the Washington Post burn Richard Nixon down. Pretend not just that our lives depend upon it, but just think maybe your lives depend upon it, because your lives do depend upon it. Two other reporters, Jonathan Swan and Peter Baker, were sent out to defend the publisher personally. Peter Baker texted a media reporter, quote, "I've never heard AG say anything like that and can't imagine he ever would." Swan posted, "I have spoken to AG over the past year." Sorry, he's Australian. "I've spoken to AG over the past year about this topic. And this caricature is unrecognizable. It's such a BS mischaracterization of his views about the importance of serious, long-form presidential interviews." Boys, I have bad news from you, or for you, rather. I have been personally talking to bosses on the A.G. Sulzberger level. I mean owners, corporate chairmen, founders, the big guys, since I went to work for Ted Turner in 1981. Immelt, Iger, the head of Tribune Broadcasting, guys at CBS, dozens of presidents at NBC, you name them. The higher up they are, the more likely they are to never tell you the truth. Oh, they'll talk to you, and they'll tell you to call them by their first names so you can say, "I've never heard AG say anything like that," or "I've never heard Ted say anything like that," or, you know, "Immelt was telling me," or, you know. And while they're doing that, they are telling your boss's 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 boss exactly what to do and to have you do it. But the real tell on how phony the Times issued on this was their formal denial. The statement, "It is true that the Times has sought an on-the-record interview with Mr. Biden, as it has done with all presidents going back more than a century. If the president chooses not to sit down with the Times because he dislikes our independent coverage, that is his right, and we will continue to cover him fully and fairly either way." By the way, this sounds like the A.G. Sulzberger they talked about in the Politico piece, like he wrote this statement himself. It's petulant and it's childish. "However, in meetings with Vice President Harris and other administration officials, the publisher of the Times focused instead on a higher principle, that systematically avoiding interviews and questions from major news organizations doesn't just undermine an important norm, it also establishes a dangerous precedent that future presidents can use to avoid scrutiny and accountability. That is why Mr. Sulzberger has repeatedly urged the White House, blah, 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 blah." The punchline is this issue of this Times statement about accountability and scrutiny and principle and precedent and journalism and the New York Times statement about all this is anonymous. It's attributed to a spokesperson. Nobody will put their name on it. We're talking about journalistic accountability, and the Times is acting as a background source. Frauds. Sell the team, Sulzberger. But our winner, here we go. It's finally come to this. What could possibly top A.G. Sulzberger and his personal grudge against the President of the United States so that he is tampering with news coverage in the New York Times to favor a guy who would burn the New York Times to the ground and think he was being generous by asking everybody to leave the building first. What could top that on the worst person's list? What could ever in a million years top that? It's finally come to this. Someone I lived with for 3 years, with whom I remained good friends for 8 years, whose rent I paid for the year after we broke up, so she could keep going in her career and not have to leave New York. Such good friends that she asked me to write her book for her. I'll go into length about that coming up. But it's Katie Turr, and she's jumped the shark. She trends an average of once a week, maybe it's twice a week, for saying something ineffably stupid and biased and pro-Trump on MSNBC. It's like watching a football team lose every week for 5 seasons in a row with the same interception at the same moment in the same fashion every week. And yesterday, the team she lost to was quarterbacked by Nancy Pelosi.
Joe Biden is doing that, created 9 million jobs in his term in office. Donald Trump has the worst record of job loss of any president. So we just have to make sure people know.
That was a global pandemic.
He had the worst record of any president. We've had other concerns in our country. If you want to be an apologist for Donald Trump, that may be your role, but it ain't mine. And he has the worst.
I don't think that anybody can accuse me of that.
Let me just say.
Okay, see, the problem isn't that Nancy Pelosi stuffed Katie Turr in a locker, in her own locker, on her own TV show, live. And the problem isn't even that Katie, whom Trump used to try to, you know, get killed, has become what my friend Speaker Emerita Pelosi called her just there, an apologist for Trump, and she has. It's what Katie mumbled during that. I don't think anybody can accuse me of that. Katie, I'm accusing you of becoming an apologist for Donald Trump. While she was on the trail covering Trump in 2016, nobody did a better job covering Trump. And nobody supported Katie, nor defended Katie, nor advocated for Katie, even within NBC, long after I left, still advocating for her in there. Nobody did it more than I did. And she did great and courageous work. And somehow, since then, she has turned into an apologist for Donald Trump. I'll go into why in the last segment. I have a theory. But the point here is, isn't there anybody who cares enough for her to tell her that it's not just Nancy Pelosi or some random Democrat accusing her of that? It's everybody! Everybody! Every day! Am I the only person who even cares this much to tell her, yes, that's what you've become. Get some help. I'm the only one and I can't stand her anymore. Because she turned on me too. And I'm the only one who's willing to say this. Other than 5 million people on Twitter every day. The first measure of mental health is, can you correctly guess, just more or less, can you correctly guess what all those around you think of you and how they would describe you? And if the former Speaker of the House accuses you of being a Trump apologist, and you say, I don't think anybody can accuse me of that, and within minutes you are trending on Twitter, and everybody is saying you are a Trump apologist, Pelosi is right, you have not correctly guessed what those around you think of you. Katie, for God's sake. We'll never talk again in our lives, and I'm fine with that. But you've lost the plot. And worse yet, that little condescending snarl in your voice there to Nancy Pelosi? You sound like effing Harris Faulkner from Fox. Katie, maybe that will wake her up. Turr, today's...
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man.
It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
First person in the world. More on Katie Turr next. For a year and a half after he came down that escalator, Donald Trump tried to get Katie Turr killed, called her out repeatedly at his campaign speeches, pointed her out to his mobs. Sooner rather than later, they had to get her Secret Service protection. Last Friday on MSNBC, Katie carried so much water so quickly for Trump that she was still trending for it on Saturday, and she was the headline story on nearly every right-wing propaganda website. Not good. She insisted he was a legend in New York City. Trump is synonymous with New York. She then posited that there were no true victims in the business fraud case, for which Trump must now pay $355 million in fines. She asked a panel of startled guests, is this fair to go after Donald Trump like this in this environment? I don't know where to begin here. I am beginning to suspect sort of late blossoming Stockholm syndrome or blackmail, maybe, or something else unknown in this equation. When they asked Katie to go cover Trump's announcement that he was running, she was working out of NBC's London bureau and was only back here in the city for a few days to meet her new boss and stop by and visit her old friends and me. She told me she did not want anything to do with American politics. She had gotten an interview with him when she eventually went to cover his announcement. He knew that she and I had lived together in one of his buildings. The interview was good. It was contentious. In many respects, it was the last solid interview anybody ever did with Trump. And NBC immediately saw that and asked her to cover his campaign full time, figuring it would sputter out at some point, but that she had access to him. She told me she didn't want anything to do with that either, and I suggested that was probably the wrong answer and that I'd help her get through it, that it could make her career. So off she went. She would send me her NBC story scripts to edit or rewrite for her, and as the threats continued against her, I'd just try to be supportive and reassuring. I had broken up with her 7 years earlier, but we had parted it as friends. I had never had any reason to doubt that that would continue. And then one day, I attacked Kellyanne Conway on Twitter. I know, not a very high bar, but still, I did it. The next thing I know, I'm getting a text from Katie Turr and then a phone call, and she's really angry at me, saying Conway called her up about what I had tweeted, and that I needed to remember that there were decent people on both sides and bad ones, and everybody got threats, and it was really inappropriate for me to contribute to the, quote, dangers Kellyanne Conway faced. I said something about, well, yeah, I'm sure there are decent people on both sides, but she's not one of them. I said to her, Kellyanne Conway? You're worried about Kellyanne Conway? She's part of a gang that has spent the last year trying to get you killed. Killed! Not inconvenienced, not fired. Killed! Enough that the Secret Service stepped in. Are you nuts? Well, it turned out Kellyanne Conway was one of Katie's sources. In fact, she might have been the main source for the networks and the big newspapers during the 2016 campaign and beyond. Apparently, she cannot stop talking. But even so, Katie's attitude towards her and against me was out of the blue and really offensive. Anyway, it passed, and maybe 2 months later, I got a text from her, 9:14 p.m. on December 11th, 2016. This is called having the receipts. Trump had won, our nightmare had begun, and Katie had gotten a book deal about her experience. I'd been keeping a document in my laptop with hundreds of pages of Trump stories and links and commentaries that I used for the Resistance video series for GQ. It was my Trump doc. And given that Katie was writing that book, I'd offered to give her a copy of it so she had something chronological to use as research as she wrote her book, because she hadn't really been keeping notes. She'd just been trying not to get killed. I still have her text. It reads, "Do you still want to share your Trump doc with me?" I joked back, "Sure, how much?" And she joked back, $10, $20. And while we were texting, I emailed her the doc, and I said, "No charge, but don't forget my one demand. Do not leave me out of your acknowledgments in your book." More than a month later, at 2:35 p.m. on Sunday, January 22nd, 2017, I was just back from L.A., and I had just done Bill Maher's show for the last time, and Katie Turr texted me about why they had never invited her to be on Bill Maher's show. And then she switched topics. Quote, "Want to write this book?" I wrote back at 5:32, "What? You're not serious. How would that work?" That's when she phoned. She was about to give the advance money back to the publisher. "I can't write a book. I'm like 50,000 words short, and it's terrible. I'll give you half the money. I'll give you more than half the money." I pointed out to her that I had written or rewritten dozens of her stories for NBC News and MSNBC, and it was not the question of the money. It was a question of what we could get away with. No viewer, and maybe only one producer in a million, would ever notice that one sentence or one paragraph of one script in her 2-minute report was actually written by me or even sounded like me. First of all, she was the one saying it. Each time I wrote or rewrote in her name for NBC, it was a fireable offense for her, but one that nobody would ever think to look for, even though there is necessarily an email trail 10 miles long. But a book about Trump in my writing style, not hers, in print? I have a fairly distinct writing style, and I'm not good at hiding it. Somebody would notice. Her publisher might cancel it or even sue. Or if it got published, NBC might notice it and fire her. This was not just a bad idea, I pointed out to her, and very dubious ethically, but it stood an excellent chance of destroying her career and maybe damaging mine. She said, okay. And she told me she was going to talk it over with her boyfriend, Tony, from CBS that night. And her thought was to give back the advance and cancel the book. And I said, did you think about a ghostwriter? And she said, like who? And I said, I had no idea. I tried to joke her out of these grim prospects by reminding her that at least for the several thousand dollars worth of research I gave her, I had cut the price to no dollars and no cents, and all I wanted was to not be left out of the acknowledgments. The next thing I knew, the book had been published. She didn't give the money back. There was not a paragraph of it that reads like the rest of her writing. And the 3 years we lived together is reduced to about four paragraphs in which she tells the story of the day Kellyanne Conjob called her to complain about me. The book dismissed me as somebody she dated briefly in her 20s. I mean, I paid off her student loans. I rented an apartment for her after we broke up for a year so she could continue to work in this city. And punchline of all punchlines, remember my one request to her, don't leave me out of the acknowledgments? She left me out of the acknowledgments. There were later problems. She talked me out of doing an interview with the Washington Post that wanted to interview me about her, saying she wasn't going to participate in the story, and it was sexist to call her ex-boyfriend, and she hoped I wouldn't do it either, and I agreed. It was sexist. Then the article came out, and she had done the interview for it. And the article reads, her former boyfriend, Keith Olbermann, refused to comment for this article, and I look like a schmuck. Then a month or two later, there's a New York Times article about her and the book, and it says I had refused the writer's request to comment to the Times. And not only did nobody from the Times ever request a comment, but I didn't even recognize the writer's name. So I find it, call her up, and I say, have we ever spoken before? And she says, no, but I asked Katie to ask you for a comment, and she called me back, and she said she'd spoken to you and asked you to do the interview with me, and you said no. And I said, bad news, she never called me. The writer gasped. But the problems at the Times is a subject of an entirely different commentary. So that was the last time I had any contact with Katie Turr. I told her that that was it for the friendship. She said she was sorry. She was a terrible person. I've done all the damage I can do here. Thank you for listening. Countdown musical directors Brian Ray and John Philip Chanel arranged, produced, and performed most of our music. Mr. Ray was on guitars, bass, and drums. Mr. Chanel handled orchestration and keyboards, produced by TKO Brothers. Other music, including some of the Beethoven compositions, were arranged and performed by the group No Horns Allowed. The sports music is the Olbermann theme from ESPN2, written by Mitch Warren Davis, courtesy of ESPN Inc. Our satirical and pithy musical comments are by Nancy Faust, the best baseball stadium organist ever. Our announcer today was my friend Stevie Van Zandt, and everything else was pretty much my fault. So that's Countdown for this, the 190th day until the 2024 presidential election, the 1,211th day since Defendant J. Trump's first attempted coup against the democratically elected government of the United States. Use the 14th Amendment and the not regularly given elector objection option. Use the Insurrection Act. Use the justice system. Use the mental health system to stop him from doing it again while we still can. The next scheduled countdown is tomorrow. Bulletin says the news warrants. Till then, I'm Keith Olbermann. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, and good luck. Countdown with Keith Olbermann is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.